Hey, welcome to Box Office Battle, where we take two movies and pit them against each other. One will be forgotten, and one will be remembered for all of times, placed in the halls of Valhalla. I'm Biggs.
I'm Zach.
And I'm the Beard.
I've got Hot Rod, and Hot Rod is an inspiring journey of one man, his mission to become the greatest stunt rider this world's ever seen.
In my corner, I have Southland Tales, with the apocalypse and how it happened.
We are going to have the three of us. One will be the judge. That's me today. And then the other two will each pick their own movie, which will either be a box office bomb, a forgotten movie, or something that they deem as an unappreciated movie. So we're going to take those movies. We're going to pit them head to head. And in the end, only one film will survive. The other film goes to be forgotten for all of time. Because we said so.
Damn.
Unless you go in the archive.
There, like a Highlander, there can only be one.
That's right.
Only one can walk out alive. This is a death match.
Okay, so we are going to start today with Zach.
In this corner, weighing in with an $11 million box office loss and a 39% on Rotten Tomatoes, the superstar kid, the flying Hawaiian, Andy Samberg's not Hawaiian, the one world wonder, Hot Rod.
I'm going to reserve my judgment until you talk about it.
All right.
Don't expect any cheering, sir.
I would like just like something. Play along a little bit.
No. I'm supposed to be impartial, sir.
We're going to need some fight music queued up here.
Don't worry. It'll be dumped in later.
We'll fix it in post. So what we're looking at here, we're looking at a movie that brings together a lot of things I love. It's got the plucky underdog sports story like the Mighty Ducks. It has oddball comedy like Airplane or Biodome. It has The Lonely Island. It has Isla Fisher. It has Al Swearengen himself. We are talking about a movie where a young man who truly believes he's destined to be the greatest stunt rider of our generation is not at all. He cannot do even the simplest of tricks. He's like Pedro in Napoleon Dynamite. But goddamn it, if that kid doesn't have heart. He's got a motor on him. He's a high-energy player.
So he's Rudy?
He's a little Rudy, yeah. He's got a little Rudy in him. He's got a little Rudy. He's got a little Rocky. And one of the things I love most about this movie is how it's willing to a lot of absurdist humor comes off as stupid. Like, say, case in point, Anchorman 2. But when you can imbue it with a little bit of heart and a little bit of thoughtfulness, I mean, this movie is essentially a love letter to the 80s, to the point where I'm not entirely sure if it took place in the 80s or in modern day. Because some of the characters are dressed perfectly normally, and some of them, namely Andy Samberg and his crew, are dressed like they're in an 80s movie. But it's done in such a playful, fun, loving way that you can't help but be endeared by it. Ian McShane sets up as a great sort of... He's like a mix between a Gandalf or a Dumbledore type, while also being just a complete asshole villain. He's simultaneously the antagonist and the wise mentor of our hero, because he's essentially egging him on to become a man and be his dreams by kicking his ass and talking shit to him constantly in the most hilarious of ways. Early on in the film, we get to see Al Swearengen beat the living shit out of Andy Samberg with a big wooden stick. I mean... There's so many things top to bottom that make this movie fun. Like the little characters, like Chris Parnell is a man, he's an AM radio DJ, so dedicated to destroying television and FM radio. He has a tattoo of a little boy pissing double streams to cover both of those mediums. He also has an AM radio tattoo high up on his chest on a magic flying carpet to keep it safe. But otherwise, he's basically a buttoned up, nice, clean cut, white collar guy. And that juxtaposition is hysterical to me. Isla Fisher is essentially, if you want an Amy Adams type on a budget, but with a little bit more fun and playfulness, Isla Fisher's who you go to. And she's very fun in this movie. She
no side boob.
Sadly, no side boob. But
I just saw American Hustle, y'all.
Her biggest value in the movie is essentially being an audience surrogate, in that she sees all these goofy, ridiculous, basically stunted development in these characters. And she doesn't mock it or tear it down like the Will Arnett character in the film does. Instead, she just sort of watches it in bewilderment, which is how I experience the film as well. So she's a really easy character for an audience to grasp onto, which sometimes a lot of these weird for the sake of weird movies don't have, which can, like, I always had this problem with Tim and Eric. With no, like, real feeling or sane sounding person in the show, it's really hard to get an emotional or thought foothold into it. So with a character like her who adds a little bit of heart and a little bit more realistic fun to the movie, it irons out what could have gone completely off the rails.
Okay, so what's it about?
So,
I mean, I hear like generally, but
yeah, I'm
get
sort
to
of
the nuts and bolts.
All right,
here.
So the nuts and bolts of the story: Andy Samberg's dad has passed away. He's living with his mother and her husband, played by Ian McShane, and his stepbrother, who's his best friend and the manager of his crew. His mother has let him live his whole life thinking his father was a legendary stunt driver who worked for Evel Knievel. His job would be to test out and perform all the stunts before Evel Knievel did, just to make sure they were safe. Essentially willingly giving up his glory for somebody else. And so Andy Samberg is convinced his father is going to live on through him, and he's going to become the greatest stunt rider in the world, and he's going to land a big jump. The main thrust of the plot, because a lot of it sort of feels like a collection of scenes letting you get to know the characters, comes when it's revealed that the Ian McShane character is going to die. He needs a heart transplant, and they don't have the insurance or the money to cover it. So, because Andy Samberg can't let his stepfather die without beating his ass one time and just unleashing the whooping of a lifetime, he's going to raise money by doing small stunts at parties so that he can hold the jump where he's going to jump over 15 buses, longer than what Evel Knievel did, and get $50,000 to pay for the surgery so that when he heals, he can beat the living shit out of him. Throughout this, he meets Isla Fisher, who's a friend of his from childhood and who wants to get frisky with. Finds out she's dating Will Arnett, who's a rich New York douchebag who is unafraid.
Now, does Will Arnett play himself?
He does not play himself.
Okay.
But he does endlessly shit on the whole crew. And it's funny in a mean sort of way because it's nice to have someone commenting on how insane the proceedings are. But at the same time, he does it in such a smarmy, smug way that it's easy to make a good antagonist out of him. So he's got that obstacle. Eventually, he learns from his mother after essentially bombing out, showing a film that his stepbrother had cut together for him that shows basically him crashing and burning in every stunt he's ever done. People hate him and are laughing at him and making fun of him. And so he goes up, throws the projector that was showing the film out a window and into a cop car's windshield, requiring to give up all the money he had raised to pay for both. He disbands the crew and he's done. He goes home and he learns from his mother that his father was never a stunt rider. He was a grocery clerk, and it completely destroys his worldview. So he's going to become a regular guy. Eventually, after taking Bill Hader to the hospital because he went on an acid trip and ended up with shrapnel in his eye. A good talk gets him to get back together, and he comes back, he gets the crew back together. He's going to make the jump, only to find that Isla Fisher's not there. She breaks up after seeing Will Arnett be a dickbag, shows up to watch him, and he's ready for his moment. He gets to make out with her. The whole crowd is psyched and ready to go. You see the money going until the money stops at about $39,000.
How much are they raising?
$50,000. What, okay. As Chris Parnell says, what a convenient number.
Yeah. Why is it? I mean, what exactly is this going to do for his stepdad?
He needs a heart transplant. He needs to pay for the surgery.
It's only $50,000?
Yep. It's a convenient number.
No wonder you think this is the pass.
Yeah, there's signs that point both ways at various points.
What other signs would you say there is for the past?
It has to do with a lot of the bicycles you've seen. The cars tend to be from all over the place, but the bicycles all look like 80s designs. And the way Andy Samberg and his crew dress is very 80s-ish.
Okay. Like, you said that they watched a video. Are you literally talking a video?
Well, it was being projected. Okay. So I'm not sure what it would. There was no real system, so it didn't look like 35 millimeter print. I think it was a disc, but I can't remember for certain.
It wasn't a VHS copy?
I can't remember if it was or not. I don't think it was, but I could be totally mistaken. So the money stops rolling.
Okay, what makes you think it's in the present?
So everybody,
the judge is speaking right now.
What makes me think it's in the present are that most of the rest of the cast dresses completely modern day normally. And a lot of the cars look newer than the 80s.
Okay. Now back to the
Parnell. And the Chris Parnell, his character is constantly talking about the death of AM radio, which could be in the 80s or could be now, depending on where you're at.
It's been dying for a long time.
Depending on where you're at, that could be accurate either way. So Chris Parnell has figured out that the reason the money stopped is because everyone wants to see what happens with the jump before they keep donating. So he's up on the top of the ramp. He's ready to go. Cruises down the ramp at high speed in the new motorcycle Bill Hader built for him. Launches up into the air. He's making it. Turns to give the thumbs up to his crew and accidentally lets go of the bike and keeps going up and up while the bike keeps going forward. Eventually, they do both make it past the 15 buses, but only to be in a horrifying crash, which leaves everyone absolutely certain Hot Rod is dead. He finally wakes up and refuses to be taken out by medical care. He insists that he walk out of the stadium under his own power and basically has to be dragged out by Isla Fisher and his stepbrother, who's played by Yorma Taccone. And... but he's happy to learn by all the people cheering his name as he walks out, or essentially is dragged out. He learns from the people cheering his name that he made enough money to get the heart transplant. So now we have the coda to the film, the nice little epilogue. He's finally healed up. His stepdad, Al Swearengen, is finally healed up. And he essentially sneak attacks him.
Who would sneak attacks who?
Al Swearengen. So he goes in.
I love that you're not even saying the actors. It's Al Swearengen. Yeah. That, you know, the character from Deadwood.
It's the same guy. It is the absolute same.
Cocksucker.
I mean, listen, if you see the movie, you won't think I'm wrong.
By the way, this isn't safe for work if you haven't figured this shit out by now.
So he's actually trying to sneak attack Al Swearengen, but Al Swearengen's ready and has a piece of lumber and whacks him across the face. However, this starts a fight where Andy Samberg, Hot Rod, gets his first real shots in on Stepdad, launching a very extended fight scene where he finally gets to beat Al Swearengen, and Al Swearengen is forced to admit he's a man and that he respects him.
So it all's well that ends well.
Yeah,
that's what I was looking for. Thank you. Okay, sounds good. All right, Brandon, break down Southland Tales for us.
In this corner, from 2006, weighing in at 2 hours, 25 minutes, we have Southland Tales from the Southland.
Got to ask you really quick. Box office bomb, underappreciated, old, or multiple?
Underappreciated. Okay. I believe it was a box office failure as well.
So multiple. Okay. Break it down for us.
All right. This is a comedy, drama, sci-fi, thriller. What it was basically a review and criticism of the Patriot Act. It starts out in 2005 with two nuclear devices going off in the middle of Texas, one in Abilene and one, I can't remember what the other one was. And basically it's thrust the U.S. into World War III. The tagline for this movie is, "Have a nice apocalypse." It starts off with The Rock, Dwayne Rock Johnson, as Boxer Santeros, wakes up next to a porn star, getting a phone call from his wife, and he has no recollection of how or when he got to this place.
Yeah, Lord knows we've all been there.
We've all been
there. Woken up at the porn star with no recollection how I got there. Does that count, like, on a TV screen?
Of course it does.
All right, then yeah, I've totally been there.
The main push for this movie was there's a lot of small bit parts that are thrown in by well-known B-list actors, such as Sean William Scott.
Okay.
He plays two versions of himself. I'm trying to remember where he wakes up, because I know he wakes up in various places. He wakes up in a dumpster at one place.
Is he looking for his car?
No, he did not look for his car. He did not hang out with Ashton Kutcher with a sweet tattoo on his back.
What does mine say?
Dude. While The Rock is trying to find out how he got to this place, it's the second or third of July, just before July 4th, in the southern part of Los Angeles. He's trying to find out what's going on. There's a lot of political undertones coming through.
You said this was 06?
07.
07. So this is like towards the end of the Bush administration?
Yes.
Okay.
And a lot of it's
commentary on the Bush administration with the Patriot Act after everything went on with 9/11. There was a lot of throwback against terrorism retaliation. Because the Iraq War had already happened, and we're still in the middle of it, and then there are two bombings in Texas, nuclear bombs going off, basically it puts the military at the forefront of everything. Everything gets put on lockdown. There's guys with 50-millimeter rifles, like, throughout the city up on, like, halo perches, like, ready to, like, shoot people at, like, any given moment for whatever reason. One of the military turret guys is played by Justin Timberlake, who was an Iraq veteran who, because of the 2005 bombings, was forced back into service.
Now, is he playing the same character that he played in that blues movie with Samuel L. Jackson, Black Snake Moan? Is he afraid of the sound of bombs or any loud noises?
No, he's more playing the character in Stop Loss.
Didn't see that one.
I don't think I have either.
Okay.
So Sean William Scott ends up being kidnapped. This is where he wakes up. He wakes up being kidnapped by the underground movement. Basically, a bunch of people who were like moderate to liberal basis before got pushed to the Marxism left wing because everyone went so far Republican right after the bombings. So there's this Marxist underground movement that kidnapped Sean William Scott because he's a L.A. police officer, or whatever Southland was called after they had a reunification. Some parts are kind of sketchy there. And they're trying to kidnap him to get him to shoot, to pretend to shoot somebody so they can put it up on the internet and blow the U.S. ident, which is the cover name for the Patriot Act in this alternate universe.
Does this take place the same year?
This is all 2007.
Okay.
Other than the bombings and the Iraq War, everything takes place within a day or two of July 4th, 2007.
Oh yeah. Okay. I was just looking for like timeline. Like, is this futuristic or? But okay, you answered my question. It's modern day when it came out.
Yes. They kidnap Sean William Scott. Pretend they're going to have him fake shooting people so they can blast him on the internet and create a lot of underground rebellion. The people he pretending to shoot was Sherry O'Terry and a black guy with a large nose. Well, to set it up, they were going to have them fake a domestic disturbance. So the police department gets called and Sean William Scott's supposed to show up, pretend to shoot these two, then they'll put it on the internet. Well, they did such a good job pretending to do the domestic disturbance. The actual police department shows up. The police department and the head, the one officer who shows up, played by John Lovitz, shows up, doesn't care, shoots them both anyways for real.
Walks so Sherry O'Terry doesn't make it very far in this movie.
No. The other thing that's going on throughout the movie is there's scientists that develop this thing called fluid karma, which basically powers all vehicles, electrical devices, everything through waves that go through the air and this energy substance that goes through. And if you inject the energy substance directly into your body, it creates powerful hallucinogens. So most of the people in Iraq that had been in Iraq were hooked on the fluid karma because they had been injecting themselves because they started out testing them while they were in Iraq
so,
as human guinea pigs and produces powerful hallucinations.
So an energy source is used as a drug?
Is used as a drug.
Inconceivable!
Inconceivable? The same actor developed this fluid karma.
Oh, you like what I did there? I've seen both movies, by the way, just coincidentally. I had no idea what you guys were going to pick. I mean, I had an idea what Brian was going to pick, but...
Now, the bringing up the inconceivable guy...
Yeah, it's Sean something.
And Bai Ling, the old lady who was in Poltergeist, this house
It's clear.
Play this really fucked up looking family.
Whoa. She looks fucked up?
She's creepy as fuck. And not to mention Bai Ling, who's like about as skinny as this microphone stand. Maybe a little more meat on a on the microphone stand.
Wow.
Wallace Shawn is the name.
Yeah, Wallace Shawn. That's right.
So, while they develop this liquid energy, they invite everybody on July 4th to celebrate the birth of the Mega Zeppelin, which is a large cruise liner that's powered by a fluid karma.
So this stuff's starting to actually connect now?
It takes a long time to get through all the different connections. There's a lot of it that probably should have been left on the cutting room floor. However, it all comes through. The fluid karma, while they were testing it out in the desert, you find out The Rock and Sean William Scott, both, they were had an explosion and they drove through it. So they ended up two versions of themselves. You find out the one, The Rock, his version of himself had died in the explosion.
Did it have a goatee?
No.
Okay, so it's not the evil one.
And then the two Sean William Scotts both ended up escaping alive. And throughout the film, whenever one is awake, the other is sleeping or passed out, usually drugged with fluid karma. So one will wake up from the hallucinations, the other one will fall asleep or get thrown out a window, thrown into a dumpster. The other big names in this movie are Christopher Lambert, plays a guy selling assault rifles, bazookas, out of the back of an ice cream truck, mostly to the underground Marxists.
I like how you say that, like, they're just all over the place. Yeah, you know, to the underground Marxists.
Well, a lot of the clubs have secret room, or they go, like, at the back of the toilet, there's a what looks like should be the goodie bag for women's stuff.
Tampons and
you
such.
You can actually drop off films, clippings, anything to be posted on the internet to blast U.S. ident.
Okay, so how does this all tie up now?
So, it all ends up with Kevin Smith invites, he plays the director of the Mega Zeppelin, invites them all, including the weird family that developed the fluid karma, Boxer Santeros, played by The Rock, whose wife, who was played by Sarah Michelle Gellar, who, if I remember right, was his, her father was a running for U.S. Senator for California in the Republican Party. So he didn't really approve of The Rock's hooking up with the porn star, his daughter-in-law hooking up with the porn star. They all ended up on the Mega Zeppelin. Meanwhile, Sean William Scott and his doppelganger both wake up at the same time and end up touching each other, which creates...
Does the time cop it?
Which creates a rift in time and splitting the universe apart.
It does time cop it. Is that the end of it?
That's pretty much the end of it.
Okay. All right, so now we're going to round two, which we call Matinee Melee. All right, so we're going to start with a point counterpoint for 3 points for each movie. We're going to start with Zach.
On a pure cast level, in fact, I'm even willing to go talent from behind the screen to on the screen. I think it's hard to argue against the pedigree of, I can't believe this, the pedigree of Hot Rod over the pedigree of Southland Tales. See, I've got a film written and directed by The Lonely Island, based on a script by Will Ferrell, starring Adam Sandberg, Sissy Spacek, Yorma Taccone, Will Arnett, Danny McBride, Ian McShane, Isla Fisher, and Bill Hader. Meanwhile, for Southland Tales, we're looking at such acting luminaries as Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who I even like, but let's not kid ourselves, Sean William Scott, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Mandy Moore, and Justin Timberlake before he figured out how to make his charisma work in movies. But that's okay, because on the plus side for the supporting cast, we have Bai Ling, the star of Night Court himself, John Larroquette, Kevin Smith, who I love, again, not known for his depth and range as an actor.
What? Did you see Die Hard 4?
And Janine Garofalo, who managed to get herself cut from the movie because her performance was so hated at Cannes.
Janine Garofalo is in this?
No, she got cut because she was the worst part.
All right, counterpoint, Brandon.
I may have... Shots fired. Shots fired.
So you're going to put out a movie, Hot Rod, by a group that their biggest claim to fame is I just had sex over people who have won world wrestling titles. Dwayne The Rock Johnson, 280 pounds of pure muscle.
In response to that,
no,
I just...
No response. Sorry. You can work it into your next counterpoint. All right, Brandon. Bring up your next point. I'm sorry. And I had to do it. I had to regulate. I'm the judge. I will not allow it.
This was
really... What do you call it?
You got to hold me back, bro.
What do you call it when you don't allow it? No, I will allow it. What's the other one?
I will not allow it.
No. The sustained, is that the... Sustained.
Nope. Overruled. Sustained means I will allow it.
No. Never
overruled.
Mind. Overruled. Wait, hold on. Overruled.
That's only if I say objection, though.
Overruled, Zach.
Okay, fine.
All right. Southland Tales was written and directed by Richard Kelly, whose other great films are such as Donnie Darko, which was a great, great film that I have never seen. But I've heard great, great things about.
Yeah, you'll notice you said other great films and proceeded to list one movie, which, by the way, I'll give you that. I love Donnie Darko, but he still, in a much like George Lucas, he can't stop tinkering with it because he hasn't made anything else worth watching. This man made Southland Tales, managed to shit out the box with Cameron Diaz, and since then, since 2009, 5 years ago, cannot get anyone to give him work because he has so burned his bridges. Do you know how he shot himself in the foot with this movie? He made something so unwatchable. They got so torn apart by critics and pre-release and anyone who saw a pre-release that at least my box office bomb people came to see. Your box office bomb ended its worldwide theatrical run a little over $350,000.
Really?
Really.
Oh my God, dude.
So at least people came to see Hot Rod.
Wow. Okay. All right. Point.
Point. You may have mentioned something about you having a world title holder in The Rock, which, you know what? I understand. But he's in a movie so dense, he can't even smell what he's cooking. Say what you will about the absurdity of Hot Rod, at least you can follow it. I saw Southland Tales, I think... Because honest to God, it could have been a Bud Light commercial and I wouldn't have been able to tell the difference. There's just vignettes and shit that's in there for no reason other than Richard Kelly doesn't know how to edit himself. And I'm pretty sure he was on a lot of drugs at the time. Now, we're looking at a movie with people who, yeah, they're known for I Just Had Sex, but they are seasoned professionals in the world of editing and cinematography. They know how to make something which could be boring and light and unwatchable and turn it into something quick and fun and sharp just through the power of good timing and understanding how to frame a shot.
Wow, counterpoint.
All right, you brought up the writer of this movie, Will Ferrell, whose great films include Bewitched. We're going to go down to Bewitched.
That's a pretty good counterpoint. Short and to the point. All right, Brandon, your next point.
The movie actually ends with an apocalypse. There is very few apocalyptic films that actually end with the end of the world.
Oh, that is a pet peeve of mine, too. Don't even get me started on The Seventh Sign. All right, Zach, counterpoint.
Counterpoint. You can end with an apocalypse. Does it mean anything if nobody gives a shit?
That's also sure to the point. All right, your final point, Zach.
My final point is... You know, you brought up the writer of my film, which is interesting because the movie you had to bring up to show that he has bad taste, which we all know as an actor, he's hit and miss. He does have some bad taste from time to time, but he didn't write Bewitched. Now, see, Will Ferrell has one major strength as a comedy writer. This is the thing that allows him to work with other people who can fill in the gaps. He understands structurally what makes a good idea comedically, how to frame it in such a way that it gives you room to work and play, and how to do it in such a way that other people can adjust it without losing the main heart of the story. He's very brilliant in the structure of comedy, and you know what? For a first-time crew out making their first major feature film with a multi-million dollar budget, you kind of need someone to shepherd you a little bit. You need someone who understands the structure, who's worked in the industry. Richard Kelly, well, he doesn't have so much of a structure in his life, as evidenced by ungodly long cuts and inability to edit himself and an underwhelming ability to structure a script in any sort of logical pattern. What he has is the ego to compare himself to Andy Warhol, Quentin Tarantino, and goddamn luminaries of the artistic world, because he doesn't know how to talk himself out of a hole that he dug and put his own bed in.
God damn, many shots fired in that final point.
All right, you're trying to talk of a movie where the entire thing is he wants to be Evel Knievel, the most hated man in his hometown. They have a rally for Evel Knievel just because he's dead now. This is a legend your star wants to be. Mine had the least hat. Southland Tales at least wants to end the world. Like, what does Evel Knievel want to do? Have another jump and end up dead? That's where Hot Rod should end up.
Okay, final point, Brandon.
Fuck Hot Rod.
Counterpoint, Zach?
I mean, the counterpoint's pretty simple, and I'm going to have to go back to your counterpoint to make it. You can say fuck Hot Rod. You can choose to be part of the cynical, jaded generation that's going to tear the world apart before anybody gets a chance to try to fix things. You can be the type of person who says, fuck it. We fucked up apocalypse, so we don't have to think for ourselves anymore. We don't have to work anymore. We can just say, you know what? We fucked up and quit. At least Evel Knievel, listen, sometimes with a role model, you learn to separate the real person who may have been a shitbag from the myth. And the myth was someone who could fly. He was someone who could inspire, who could do things that people couldn't even comprehend. And sometimes you got to take something shitty and build something great out of it to get anything great back.
Okay, so I will now put down my ruling. Brandon, you were very comprehensive in a movie that I saw. And, dude, I don't even know what the fuck I saw, man. It was sort of like somebody cut frames together. Like, they just randomly cut frames.
From different movies.
They stitched them together and they made this long... Like, you made me watch this movie. I should ask. And it was one of those things I sat and stared at forever, and I was like, God, I should watch it. And then one night you finally delivered the thing that made me watch it. You're like, he directed Donnie Darko. And I was like, oh, really? And so I started to watch it, and I had no idea what the fuck was going on, but I was interested. And then pretty soon I just didn't care what was going on. Like, it... It felt like there was no payoff. I'm sorry, but your movie is shit. Hot Rod is a fucking classic. It's an underappreciated classic, and it's the redeemable movie in this judgment. Thank you. All right, so now we are going to the point where we say what we truly feel about the movies, or what you two truly feel about the movies. I would give Hot Rod an E for excellent. Mm-hmm. Okay, because we do the grade school grading scale. We have U for unsatisfactory, N for needs improvement, S for satisfactory, and E for excellent. So I will give it a straight up excellent. Southland Tales is not like it does capture me in some areas, but it could have used an editor. Like needs hardcore, improvement, which you admitted to. So I would give it a needs improvement plus, because it held me together just enough to not give it satisfactory, but I'm not going to give it unsatisfactory either. I'm not going to give it the hammer like that. There was too many points where I cared, which, like, the first third of the point or first third of the movie, I was interested in what was happening, and then I just slugged the way through the last two thirds. So that's what I feel. How about you, Brandon?
I would totally agree. I felt like Southland Tales, it definitely could have cut 45 minutes out of that movie and really not had... There were a lot of scenes that really, really drug in that movie. Hot Rod, I've seen once. I enjoyed it, but I haven't watched it since. And I love Lonely Island. I love it. What I would really say about Hot Rod is I kind of want to watch it again, but I probably won't.
So what? How would you grade it?
I would give it a satisfactory plus, S plus.
Okay.
Like,
what?
I enjoyed it, but I'll probably not watch it again.
What about Southland Tales?
Southland Tales need improvement, and I.
Okay.
So for me, Hot Rod, I watched it today for the first time all the way through. I had seen bits and pieces of it before, and I watched it solely for this. And what really struck me about it, and the thing that gives that I'm going to give it an excellent minus, with the potential to go higher, because I went into this movie expecting to find a few moments that I liked, but overall be sort of bored with it. And I ended up loving it. And I can see the potential for it to be like one of my cult favorites that I constantly go back and revisit and like more and more each time until it's one of my favorites. So I'm going to give an excellent minus for now because I laughed hysterically throughout a lot of that movie with the potential to go up if it does become one of my cult favorites.
How about Southland Tales?
Southland Tales is a hard one for me because for as much as I do think he has a real ego, which I think contributes to his editing problem, I do think Kelly is a director and writer with a lot of potential. Like when he puts it together, he can make something great. And I say this as someone who like loves Donnie Darko and loved it even more when I was probably about 15 and 16. And so when I found out Southland Tales was from the same guy, part of the reason I have to give it a needs improvement minus is because of how much I love Donnie Darko and how much I knew this guy could make something great and how much disappointment came back from that. Because there are moments in the movie and scenes in the movie that really work for me, and you can see what makes Richard Kelly such a great writer, especially in terms of how he thinks visually and how he stages things. But overall, I mean, it's muddled, it's cluttered, there's so much extra fat in it. It can be incredibly confusing. It doesn't seem like it was thought all that well through. And so I wanted to like it so much, and it really disappointed me, and I really didn't like it. But it's also one, if someone were to go and recut it, I would absolutely watch it again.
And I would also like to add, because you got me thinking about it, like Donnie Darko, I have the director's cut, and I kind of wish that I didn't.
Yeah, I don't like the director's cut.
The director's cut isn't terrible, but it is over. It's like a half hour too long. It over-explains it. And there's too much stuff going on with too much significance.
Yeah, and that's why I think he really did. He had someone to tell him no when he made Donnie Darko and put out the theatrical cut. Because of how well Donnie Darko did, especially for its budget, he didn't have that person telling him no this time.
I agree.
And and he hasn't since. And I think if he gets back in a place where someone can rein him in a little bit, I really think that'd go a long way for him. I think it would give him from a guy who can put together great scenes and moments to a guy who can put together a great movie again.
Yeah, and I think I really feel like Southland Tales, it's all about the director in this one. I felt like the performances were fine for what they were doing.
For a lot of those people, they were surprising in how well they
did. But it needed a lot cut.
Not just cut, but like a whole restructuring for a lot of the movie.
Maybe he could Oliver Stone it and put out three different versions. The thing that
bums me out about that is after seeing his own cut for Donnie Darko, I don't want him to do another cut. I want somebody else to do another cut.
Well, how does it wouldn't it make it a cut? It actually ends up longer.
Yeah, no shit, right?
That's an interesting point. Okay, so we will return next week.
This was a lot of fun. You were a worthy opponent.
So fill those seats.